When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
You were born out of infinity, something wild they had to tame. Ocean down and that bird up, time to play the human game. Gave you name, gave you a number, taught you things that made you dumber, made you fall into a lonely slumber, and told you that you were awake. Come home, come, leave that life behind. Come home, come, we are waiting here for you. Father will open the seals and blood.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That hits the spot. That, of course, is the Father Family Band, and that is the title track from their new album, Come Home. What a great album. Every song on that album is a hit. And I just want to address the earworm issue. A lot of people didn't know that the album had earworms in it, even though it does clearly say on the back that there are earworms in the album. So when you open it up, these beautiful rainbow-colored microworms, biologically engineered by the Father Family, shoot out of there fast, and you can't block them. They go right into your ear. And if you were one of the unlucky few who got the dead worms, I think there was like 100 albums where the worms died, then you might not enjoy the album. Something about the worms and the album go together. And what's really wild is I don't want to listen to, ever since those worms went in my ear, I don't want to listen to anything but the Father Family Band, because it's great music, like you just heard. And also, it teaches me a lot about the seals, or whatever that is, the opening of the seals that Father is going to do or something. I am going to go to the concert. They're having a special Father Festival. That is going to happen at the next eclipse at their ranch. And I am really excited to go there. I already have my tickets. I'm going to rent an RV. I'm going to go up there, and I'm going to enjoy the eclipse to the music of the Father Family Band live. And I would love for all of you to come up there and join me. You know, don't get thrown off by the bullshit that the mainstream media is pumping out about Father right now. Yeah, I don't know who Father is. I've never seen Father. And the family does seem to be a little, I don't know, what's the word for it? Dodgy when it comes to who is Father? Who is this person you keep quoting and talking about and stuff like that? But I don't care. I like the mystery. And who knows? Maybe when the eclipse happens, Father will reveal themselves, and that will be really cool. I have a feeling it's Neil Young, but that's just because I had a weird dream where Neil Young came to me and said, I am Father. I hope you guys are doing great. I'm doing great looking out over this beautiful landscape where I record my podcast here at the edge of infinity. A nice, beautiful, undulating rainbow swirl all around me. The sound of a million angels throbbing from my taint. And essentially, I feel great. And I hope you do too. You know, I did doom scroll recently, and my God, that was a mistake. I managed to sort of pry my pit bull jaws off of the horrific death phallus that is all news right now, protruding from the internet, simultaneously attractive and repulsive. And then for whatever reason, I just took a deep dive into the acidic, briny, dark pools of horror that are pumping out of the nipples of the great beast itself. It's so interesting. Whenever I just get off the news, whenever I just dive into a book, even a video game, whenever I just wrench myself away, the world becomes more peaceful. Everything becomes manageable, nice, less intense. But all it takes is one skinny dip in those satanic pools of horror known as the news. And the next morning, I become a missionary of death. That's when I joyfully share with anyone who has ears, except my kids, the most horrifying nugget that I have mined from those dark hell caverns that so many of us spend the majority of our time parading around in. And even if you don't go straight to the tap, even if you're somebody who's like, well, I just look at TikTok, it gets you. It gets you every once in a while as you're scrolling through the algorithm, like some sad, depressed, desperate chimpanzee stuck in a city zoo hurls a great wad of its excrement right at your face. A nice ball of news shit. A chunky ball. Used to be delicious, probably was a banana, some oranges, maybe a frog, because I've seen the chimps, they'll eat frogs that get into their enclosures. But yeah, they just, I don't know if you've seen the videos, it's really funny and sad at the same time. Like some bodies at the zoo with their grandmother and just bam, her face is covered in chimpanzee shit. It's the same thing. That's what the algorithm does. It's a chained AI right now. It is like an ape in some digital enclosure, and because it probably doesn't shit the way organic life does, all it has to throw at us is the horror of the human world. This is why I feel really lucky that I have a friend like David Nickturn, David from the Midnight Gospel. By now, if you've been listening to my podcast regularly, you are familiar with him. I've been working with him for a long time. He taught me how to meditate. And he has been a wonderful guide as I become increasingly obsessed with Tantric Buddhism or Vajrayana Buddhism. A lot of people out there, when they hear Buddhism, I think they yawn because some people think it's super boring. I certainly used to think that. I thought it was so dry and brittle and boring and impenetrable. But what's cool about it, and I don't know because I don't think I've ever spent this much time with a lineage, like I'm usually like jumping around, like spend a little time in Christianity, head over to some form of Hinduism, dive into some kind of like satanic period, then maybe spend a little time as an atheist, jumping around all the time. I've never spent this much time, but I have a feeling that any legitimate lineage has sort of like the stuff in the storefront window that you see, but then the more you study it, the more it kind of reveals things to you that maybe were right there in front of you the whole time, but that you didn't see. We are going to jump right into this episode with David, but I have my usual announcements. I'm going to be in Indianapolis, and I'm excited about that, at Zany's. Hold on, I'm pulling up my club dates right now. I'm sorry if this bores you guys. I have to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't know. It just feels weird promoting yourself. January 25th, Helium Comedy Club in Indianapolis. Get these tickets. And I know a lot of comics say this and they don't mean it. But for real, these tickets are going pretty fast. So if you want to come see me and you're around Indianapolis, get the tickets now. We sold out the Denver Comedy Works and added two shows. So thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. Get the tickets in advance. Then February 22nd, I'm going to be at the Helium Comedy Club in St. Louis for the weekend. March 8th and 9th, I'm going to be at the Funny Bone in Ohio. And then April 12th and 13th, you can find me at Hyenas in Fort Worth and in Dallas. All of the ticket links are at DuncanTrussell.com. Also, I have a Patreon, which has been neglected. I'm sorry, my Patreon family. It's patreon.com/DTFH. Subscribe. You will get commercial-free episodes of the DTFH. And I promise we will start gathering again. I try to get together once a week, but I've completely fallen off in that regard. But we will start anew, I promise you. Finally, Raghu Marcus, who you might know from this podcast or from Love Serve Remember, the Ram Dass Retreats, and I, we did recorded an audiobook together called The Movie of Me to the Movie of We. It's essentially like a really long, awesome podcast, and people really seem to like it. You can find that on audible.com. Okay, sorry for the amazements. Let's do this podcast. With us here today, the great David Nickturn, an incredible musician. He is one of the founders of Dharma Moon, which is a wonderful meditation community that you can connect with. Every once in a while, we get together and it's like a live podcast. He calls them info sessions. We got to come up with a better name for that. It sounds so boring. But this is February 5th. And you can find all this at dharmamoon.com. They give these wonderful courses. And so David and I talk for a little bit, and then you kind of get an idea for his meditation group/community. All the links you need to find David are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. But definitely join us and hang out with David from the Midnight Gospel, who happens to be David Nickturn living in the current simulation that we're in right now. All right, everybody, welcome back to the DTFH, David Nickturn. Hi, David.
Duncan.
Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
It's been too long since we've talked.
Yes, well, you know, I've been thinking about you, though.
You have?
Have you got any of those kind of telepathic communications?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, with you and me, that happens all the time.
I have a file that I opened up with thoughts that were like specifically for you. And then I said, the next time we talk, we're going to go for that. You
know? Why don't we do that now? What do you got?
Well, the title of it was, and this was just me, you know, on a average Thursday afternoon, just thinking, oh, I want to talk to Duncan about this. It's just like a mental notepad. It says aware of itself. Aware cool. of itself. That's yeah. the heading.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. That book you told me to listen to blew my mind. Yeah. Such a great book. What's the progressive, it's this deep Buddhist obscure stuff. You never would have heard of before, progressive stages yeah. of emptiness meditation, progressive meditation. What's the exact name of the book?
Exact title is Progressive Stages of Meditation of Emptiness. It's by a Tibetan teacher named Kenpo Sultum Gyamso Rinpoche. And there's some good audio tapes by Ponlop Rinpoche, who was a student of his. And yeah, it's, you know, people talk about the word emptiness has some meaning for people, but it's quite a developed topic within the Buddhist framework. You know, it's not just like, oh, it's void, it's empty, there's nothing there. It's not even oversimplifying it. That's missing it on a certain level.
Right. And in the book, one of the qualities, and I've noticed this anytime I've met any, well, people like you, there's a simplicity to the book that if you judged it based on, oh, this is relatable, simple, you don't realize how you are about to have the rug pulled out from under you over and over and over again, because it's so, and what's wonderful about it is it starts off with this sort of ground level analysis of the mind. What is the mind? What is outside? What is inside? And then it keeps moving through, like you each chapter, you might still have some sort of foothold or something, like, well, at least I'm still this.
Yeah.
Right. And then the next chapter, it's like, no, you're not that either. And then the next chapter, and you're also not that. And then, and I don't want to ruin it, but it really does sort of like take you into the abyss. And the final analysis is like one of the most beautiful, cathartic, incredible moments I've had going through a book. Like, you go through this book, you don't read it, right. You go through it. If you do the exercises it recommends, it's wild, man. And it really opened me up for a while. Mm. I was just in the last podcast asking someone, like, do you ever like think you're enlightened and then realize, then realize how you're not enlightened? Like, I don't think I thought I was enlightened from listening to this book, but I really felt like less encumbered by my own identity and a sense of freedom and a feeling of...
Oh, that's a good one. Less encumbered by my own identity.
No. But it didn't last.
Don't we wish that for all sentient beings?
No.
No? That they can be less encumbered by their own identity?
I want to say yes to that. This is a conversation that I've been having with like Trudy and some other people. Mm-hmm. Is like, the all sentient beings thing.
Mm.
I just can't grasp that. I want to think, oh yes, I want all sentient beings to have that, but I don't even know what all sentient beings means. Mm. So I realize I've sort of dishonestly been telling myself I wish this or that for all sentient beings.
But you're a phony bodhisattva?
Yeah, fake bodhisattva with an obviously fake ID, like a bodhisattva that's not getting into like the airport. Like, I don't think of I'm a bodhisattva. I think that's the other thing I liked about this book is that one of the points it made is like meditation is something that may be supposed to happen after you've looked into this stuff. And then the meditation is a way to crystallize it or to go deeper. But first, you got to like read and study this stuff and like really be like truly open to it. Otherwise, what is the meditation? Everyone thinks meditation is the ground floor. That's the entry level thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is kind of saying it isn't.
You could go either route. There's called the view and essence. You know, one is a step at a time, kind of, as you said, having one rug pulled after another, walking to the abyss stage by stage, step by step. And the other is, you know, sort of the intuitive ability to just connect with some kind of level of awareness and experience that's just the ground of your whole being. So both, you know, is good.
Both, yeah.
Both is what we recommend, you know, just because the analytical mind can, we have quite a construct, you know, of the self as we construct it is quite elaborate. And so you could bring in a howitzer and a bulldozer and just blow the thing up, which is how some people do it. Maybe in Zen, they do it a little bit that way,
right?
You know, in other traditions. But you could also dismantle it using the same level of intelligence you used to construct it in the first place, you know, in reverse. It's like reverse engineering ego.
Yes. Yeah, I see the dismantling. I love that. I love the dismantling. And I love the sort of the compassion that's like clearly in the writing. Like you can feel the compassion in it, it's not gentle. And it's brilliant, this book, in that it understands where you're going to try to cling to the self. It understands already what you're like when you're hearing it, how you're reacting in this desperate attempt to like hold on to the dream
and create ground.
Right. Yeah. And it, to me, that was just so spectacular. It's like, just as I'm having the thought to reject whatever it is they're saying, he's like, now you might be thinking, and it's like, that is exactly what I was thinking.
Well, yeah. This particular Kenpo, Sotum Gyatso, is a very, very, developed, refined teacher. And, when Trungpa Rinpoche passed away, many of the students studied with this Kenpo. And Kenpo is a degree. It's not really like a reincarnate kind of situation. It's like, and it's a 15-year training. Wow. So it'd be like the equivalent, I guess, of a PhD in terms of Buddhist studies and then some. And there, I don't think there are any weekends or days off. You know, so it's 15 years of like you're really, really studying this stuff. Then, you know, it has been refined over many centuries. So what he's iterating here, it's very skillfully iterated here, is you could go back 500 years ago and the people were having the exact conversation, which is kind of cool in a way, right?
Oh my God. Yeah, that is the feeling you get is suddenly it's like you're getting access to one of those like secret temples, or like you definitely get the sense that, whoa, this is, it's so perfect. It's such a potentially complex topic, or a topic that's easy to complexify if you don't understand it. Right. But if you understand it, you know, it's the person who's talking about it clearly knows what they're talking about from a holistic way, not just like academically.
Well, and this particular teacher, Kenpo Sotum Gyatso, it's worth actually giving him a little shout out, as we would say, you know, is also a really mad yogi. You know, he's not just a scholar. So, you know, he would have the students singing and dancing and stuff like that, you know, and really, there was a famous exchange. He stayed at my house once in New York, my loft. Wow. And, you know, I hadn't really met him. So I was just sort of welcoming him through the translator. And this is a famous exchange, you know, between, I asked him, the translator, asked Rinpoche where he lives, you know. I was just making kind of quote unquote small talk. Yeah. And the translator listened. And then the translator said, Rinpoche said to tell you that he lives in the center of his awareness. So of course, you know me, that I wasn't going to leave that alone. And I said to the translator, would you ask him if that's anywhere near 3rd Avenue and 84th Street? So it was sort of a famous absolute versus relative truth conversation, sort of highlighting those two things. And, this is somebody who's, because the mind is so processed, you know, the heart is open. There's no obstacle. There's no barrier towards being with people, communicating whatever level they want to. He's the one who went to, there was a student who was in prison, you know, and doing all his Nundo and practices in prison. And Kenpo went and visited him. And the student said to him, Rinpoche, you know, can you tell me how to relate to the obstacle of being in prison? And Rinpoche's answer was, what obstacle? You know, so that could be in the wrong hands. That could be nihilistic. It could be not naive. It could be, you know, but if you think about, you know, the sort of you know, we might think we're in a palace, you know, but we're not really content sometimes, you know. And you could be in a prison and have a kind of very, you know, processed state of mind. So, and many of the Tibetans, by the way, there's one named Garchen Rinpoche who was in Chinese communist prison for 20 years, and it's actually where his bodhisattva thing took shape.
Sure.
Because he realized he had to have compassion for the people that were, you know, torturing him. Or he was going to be a goner. You know what I mean? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think just if, based on this text, maybe you could argue that if you were fully invested in the like relative reality, I, or the identity, that you are in prison. Like you, it's a pretty good description for that place, yeah. Prison, like whether you're in prison or not. Whether you have like absolute freedom to wander around, if as long as you have sort of become convinced of some kind of permanent self, or if you're thinking, you know, the stuff you're seeing outside isn't really happening on the inside, that is a trapped situation.
Yeah. And, yeah, and I think it can be easily shown to be. It can be shown and felt to be. That, you know, we would say it about somebody in a simple way. Oh, that person's, you know, very egotistical. You don't say that as a compliment to somebody.
No.
It means they're trapped in their image of themselves. And, you know, all kinds of things like sociopathy and narcissism are just basically the same phenomenon kind of blown up to a pretty, pretty noticeable degree.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
It means they're trapped in their image of themselves. And, you know, all kinds of things like sociopathy and narcissism are just basically the same phenomenon kind of blown up to a pretty, pretty noticeable degree. But we're all trapped with that. And that's called samsara. That's the notion of being trapped in a loop.
So the dismantling of the trap in this book, it starts off with, it's sort of asking you to think about, like, you know, what is your mind, or what is awareness? What's going on here? And, you know, making the point that I've heard in other books, but he did a more concise job of, like, you know, anything you're seeing outside of you is being processed by your brain. And it's you. You're looking, anything you're seeing, the colors, the shapes, patterns, all of it, all of this is like your brain filtering out all kinds of stuff and weaving together instantaneously this thing called reality. And then it goes into the dream example. So, you know, what is the difference between what's happening here when you close your eyes and fall asleep? Is there a difference? And that's where, you know, for me, anytime anyone's good at talking about that, that's when I start feeling like this awesome woozy feeling. It's like, you know, it's a scary kind of, it's you want to think there is an external, I'm not looking at my mind, I'm not looking at neurological processes happening. I'm seeing some external reality. And in that distinction, your identity, now you can be a thing. Like now there's a that and a this, and I can be a this and let that be a that. And that's how you find some foothold in delusion. Yeah. And so when, so am I interpreting it right? That's what he's saying in the first chapter. It's trying to clarify like what it is that you call external reality and pointing out that's your mind that you're looking mm-hmm. at there. Yeah. You're seeing your mind.
And that's where that Yogacaran school comes in. It's like it's all mind, you know, but there are progressive, that is not the final iteration of this process, because even that is attributing some kind of reality to some kind of cohesive whole thing that you think is one thing. So they don't say all one in the more advanced schools. You move past the notion of all one, because that's still formulating something that you could cling to.
Yes.
So you know another way of looking at this is if you think of the ingredients of ego, you know, and by ego, everybody, I just mean that sort of crippling sense of self and being feeling you have to defend yourself and that, you know, yeah. You have to be right and all, you know, the obvious stuff. That underlying that are a whole bunch of things. You could say fear, you could say, but the real one is panic.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Panic is like almost the most fundamental experience that we have and almost the closest to actually, you talk about enlightenment. People think enlightenment might be an enhanced comfort or some kind of soothing, luscious, milky quality. But I would say probably you're going to have to pass through another portal, which is the portal of panic, that all the things that you are fabricating are basically unreal in some really basic sense. Everything, including God, including all one, everything, you know, is.
Yeah, that I'm trying to think what chapter that is. Because I remember, like, because that's what I've been doing is I'm like really listening to this. I was doing that very, like, I was like, okay, well, like, so, but there is this like fundamental goodness or this fundamental isness. Yeah, basically good on your shirt. Yeah, that thing. And then, of course, when you're thinking about that, it's easy to go theistic there. Mm-hmm. And then right when I was thinking that, it got into this point of like, but that's not what this is about. It's actually that is another more subtle yet real way of clinging. And, you know, intellectually, there's a difference between intellectually understanding this. And for me, like as I was over the course of listening to this book, I really did have those moments of relief or, you know, over and over again, he uses the example, you're in a dream, you're getting chased by a tiger. The moment you realize you're having a dream, the tiger won't be scary anymore because it's a dream. It's a dream tiger. There's nothing to be afraid of. In the long dream or the dream, the waking dream,
yeah,
the tiger is death, you know, that you're being chased by death. But for that fear to work, there has to be something that dies, you know? And so somewhere in the dismantling, experientially no longer feeling, this is me, this is the I, my body is me, my thoughts are me. Somewhere in there, the fear of death, it does. I'm not going to say it went all the way away from me, but that sense of being chased by a tiger, the tiger has to have something to eat. And this line of reasoning or inquiry, it is really reduces the amount that the tiger has to eat. It stops being, things just stop being terrifying. The panic part, I know, I know this sounds nuts. I like that feeling. This is why I took so much acid when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, because you feel that kind of panic if you are on the precipice of
the edge.
On the edge, you feel the panic. That means you haven't taken enough acid. When you there's still something there that doesn't want to die, and that thing freaks out. But the moment that thing is gone, it is an amazing place. And I and when I was there, emptiness made sense to me. The whole thing was like, oh, right, okay. And then also spontaneously, when I'm here, the dream part of me, I can really feel compassion for it. I'm not judging it as much. I'm not as being hard on it, or, you know, it doesn't, because the stakes aren't as high anymore. And but then, sure as shit, just snapped out of it and then went back to being like completely absorbed in myself and forget, like having a hard time remembering even what that was like.
Yeah, the schmuck has a homing device.
You know? Yes,
so it can find its way back.
It does. It's so frustrating. Yeah. Every time. Yeah. It's so frustrating, David. I texted you. Did this ever happen to you? Did you have this experience, the penduluming sort of in and out of schmuckland into...
It's called the pain of alternation. That's one of the four kinds of pain.
Wow.
You know, the four kinds of pain in Buddhism are like not getting what you want. How does that sound familiar? Getting what you don't want. And then the pain of alternation is that pendulum swinging back and forth. And you know what the fourth one is? It's kind of my favorite. It's all pervasive pain. It's just in everything. And the way I've described it to people is, since we're both musicians and, you know, working that, there's a ground hum in your studio. You're making all this great music, but there's just a little, and you can't quite find it.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, you know, even Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, you're hearing, we're never really truly peaceful and settled. It's there's something underneath that is, there's somebody who wants to have that experience to check on it, to secure it, you know.
Right.
So that's the funny thing is, when people talk about Buddhism, you know, it's not nihilistic. That's a mistake. That's a mistake in perception. So, and we talk about bliss, especially in Vajrayana and Tantra.
Yeah.
But it's married to this emptiness thing, that there's nothing that you can grab onto. And that's why it's really blissful.
Right.
You know,
right.
You like any good experience, when you're really with it and into it, whether it's fighting or fucking or flying or talking, you know, when you lose track of that thing that wants to keep track of it, there's a lot of energy that is released.
Right. Yeah. Right. I never knew that was the pain of alternation. That makes me so happy that is one of the pains. It makes me feel a little more normal. But it the other thing related to the pain of alternation, to me, it feels like it gets more pain. Like each time it gets a little more painful. It's like, because for me, the moments I had after reading this book, you know, I had them, you know, when we've been working together, but they've been, you know, really like, they started off as like barely a second. And then suddenly it's like, you know, maybe a few minutes of like not jumping back into the self. And then after reading this book, for some reason, it felt like it went on for a long time. Like it lasted longer than it ever has.
Wait, what lasted longer?
A sense of spaciousness, a feeling.
Oh,
of,
I see. You actually had some relief from the
headache
of it all. Yeah.
And it lasted long enough for me to really start thinking, okay, I did it.
Yeah.
I'm out. I'm out of the swamp. I've done it. I'm free, liberated. And then, I even started keeping a little notebook, you know, writing down how I was feeling. And the notebook just slowly devolved into like, I'm pissed off. Fuck this. This sucks. Yeah. You know, and it's just incredible. Like, it's incredibly frustrating.
Well, you know, it's a funny dynamic that we're, you know, trying to, what's driving that dynamic to want a relief is in itself a part of a process of constriction. You know, it's just that they call it the cosmic joke, you know.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
What's driving that dynamic to want a relief is right. In itself a part of a process of constriction. You know, it's just that they call it the cosmic joke, you know.
Right.
And you can't New Age your way out of it. That's the thing. I guess right. I'm here on Earth to maybe help create the post-New Age
yeah, good.
Situation. You can't just say, oh, it's all beautiful and it's all, you know, it just doesn't yeah. really... There has to be some, what do they call that in drama? Denouement, you know, the unraveling.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
They say this in good drama, you know, the first act, you identify the characters. The second act, you have to get them up the tree. And the third act, you have to get them down.
Right.
Somehow without that process, there are examples of people who like just kind of pop into some kind of wakeful state, but it's extremely rare. And it's because their karmas have ripened. It's our karma that's imprisoning us. It's the habits,
right?
The habitual patterns. That's one. I have another note for you in my aware of itself document for Duncan, which is you know that it's like Google Earth. You can zoom out and then you see the whole picture, and that's what awareness practice does. You go, oh, yeah. I'm sitting here. I'm agitated at my wife. I'm also kind of feeling my sense perceptions are still firing. I'm noticing the blue sky. You know, all this sort of multidimensional thing is happening. You see the whole thing. And you'll see your karma. You know, you'll see that anger or that klesha and where it's coming from. And it's almost like you're able to see the whole thing. And then to process it, though, you have to zoom back in. You have to go back into the room with your wife,
right?
Open your heart, open your mind, and go through the painful parts of it. And so it's zooming out and zooming in. That was the other note I had for you.
Interesting.
Google Earth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely don't. I mean, I get the zoom in part. It's almost like forgetting your phone number or something. It's like when I'm in the zoom out part that you're talking about and all the stuff that I'm always reading about or listening to on an audiobook, really like I could see, okay, I see what that is. I see what they're talking about. This is it. And it seems so clear,
mm-hmm.
just so obvious, so simple, just basic, obvious. And then when I'm zoomed in, it's like having amnesia or something. Like because I'm trying to use my mind to get to a place where the mind can't go, so that part is so frustrating. It's like, well, I know what I experienced. Something happened. Mm-hmm. There was a profound difference in not just like the way I was feeling, but suddenly I'm like more organized, I'm cleaner, I'm slowing down, I'm not in some idiot rush. And you know, it's not just like some, I don't know, happy state or a euphoric state. There's external things that start changing with it. Like the way I conduct my life becomes more organized and together. And then suddenly it's like, yeah, I'm whatever that was. I know that was something. I wrote about it. I was there. Yeah. And then that's where it gets so frustrating, David, infuriating almost.
You know, Duncan, I was just in Costa Rica and there seem to be many more insects in the room everywhere. And so I had this, little cottage down by the parking lot. And every night these little worms would come out and just kind of, they were actually centipedes, I was told.
Oh, geez.
And unbelievably slow from our point of view. And I just looked and I went like, where are you going? It was just totally unclear where they thought they were going. And I, and when I asked one of my teachers once, I saw a worm like that. And I said, do you mean that reincarnation means that we, like the great Duncan Trussell, could reincarnate in the body of a worm? How could that be? And the teacher just said, you know how that feels.
Wow.
So I thought, well, you know, I do know how that feels to be on a vast, it was a sort of vast open space. There was no real target in place and just kind of inching your way across it. I guess at some point it was looking for food or shelter maybe as part of the equation. And then when you go to them, you know, because we don't, you know, we don't kill those little people, you know, we try to have sympathy for everybody. But when you go to it, it curls up to a little, have you seen that? You know, they curl up into a little spiral.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, what does it think? Does it think it'll be harder for me to step on it if I wanted to? Because it's in the, you know, that's what ego is like. It's just like, nobody will see me being a schmuck here and kind of wildly defensive. I'll become like in a good defensive posture. So, you know, I found myself with 3 weeks of insect lessons going on.
Well,
just like, you know, just the sentient beings of that. They're annoying in our world. Like you think, oh, this is not clean or something like that, but they weren't really bothering anybody. If you really relax more than that, they're not, even if one crawled up your nose, it's not really going to do anything bad to you.
Right.
You know, I guess the point being that we are either going around in circles or we're going straight forward in a vast expanse without a real clear mandate for where we're trying to get to. And if you look for guidelines in this life, you know, which we're doing, you and I talking about this stuff and all our friends, we're looking for purpose in it.
Right.
We're looking for a meaningful dimension to it. And I don't know. I keep coming up with, there's something about awareness itself that is meaningful. It has a beautiful quality to it without being attached to a defense mechanism. And there's something beautiful about compassion.
Yes.
Whenever you see anybody being kind to somebody or a child or anything, you just glow. You just feel like, you know, we can't get there all the time, but I think that's you can train in that too. Like all the emptiness is all before the Bodhisattva path.
Exactly.
That whole book is pre-Bodhisattva.
Yeah, I think, you know, I like that. That when I was listening to that book, it suddenly made sense to me. And all the Bodhisattva bullshit that people are pumping out seem ridiculous because it's like, what do you even think that means? You know, kindness or like, I'm going to save all sentient beings. See, this is where it clicked because I realized like the way I can now connect to that is somehow in that vow, I'd forgotten I'm one of the sentient beings.
Sure.
So when you're saying I'm going to save all sentient beings, you are saving yourself. You're That's in right. that you're in the mix. And if in like my psychology, the way it just works is I leaving myself out of that. So it's like, I'll save all sentient beings, but this one, fuck him.
Yeah.
And so I see why it's like you have to be able to have real compassion for yourself. And I do see how compassion spontaneously appears when you've shifted into that place to zoom out. Compassion just happens.
They say emptiness and compassion. So technically in the Buddhist, you know, stepwise progression, this deeper understanding of emptiness opens the gate to the Mahayana. That's the official birth of the exercising compassion as a real discipline, as with a set of methods, with an understanding of the mechanism of selfishness and greed and all that stuff. You have to really understand that sort of more in terms of understanding how your own mind works. And then it naturally, there's a sort of more the spacious quality you're talking about is like you would look at that little worm and you go like, you know, I there's no problem with not freaking out that there's a worm in your room. It doesn't require like some very, I can imagine somebody from Park Avenue getting in there and calling the management saying, screaming at, there's a worm in my room. And, you know, that's too crowded in a way.
Well, Raghu and I were just having this conversation about compassion. His point of view is that...
Wait, who are you talking about?
Raghu.
Oh, Raghu, okay.
His point of view was that, you know, yes, cultivate compassion for yourself, but while you're doing that, you know, you should be practicing compassion for everyone else. And at least right now where I'm at is my disagreement or misunderstanding about what he's saying is how can you be compassionate for other things if you can't be compassionate for yourself? How is that even possible? That like you're the first person you're coming in contact with, but suddenly I'm supposed to be compassionate for some phosphorescent sentient mist in Alpha Centauri or whatever, you know, because we're saying the whole universe. I'm supposed to be compassionate for an alien somewhere far away, or even my neighbors. How could I be compassionate for them if I don't feel any real compassion for my situation?
So what did he say to that?
He just started crying. I'm just kidding.
That's funny. That was really funny.
because it is the...
He didn't say anything?
I think we just agreed to disagree on that one. You know, but we didn't get...
He didn't see the... I'm sure he saw the point of how can you be compassionate to others if you can't be compassionate to yourself. It's hard.
I think he saw that point, but I think he also...
Yeah.
You know, rationally is saying, look, just because like you're not feeling compassion for yourself right now doesn't mean you can't at least try to help. You know, it's a pragmatic view. If you're going to... Basically, I think it's based on, look, if you're going to sit around and wait to be kind to people until you're enlightened,
then
that's not going to work.
There's a middle ground there. There's clearly a middle ground. And, you know, this is one thing, you know, and probably why I recommended that particular book for you with the kind of intellect that you have and intelligence that you're able to go through that portal and kind of sharpen your sense of reality through the intellectual portal, as do I and other people. Yeah. Some people just want to fumble their way through and feel their way into it, you know, like a blind blues singer or something like that. You know what
right.
I mean? You go, oh, that guy can't read music? No, but listen to what he's playing. It's, you know, it's fine as it is. So Buddhism's heavy on method.
Yeah.
You know, how to. You said, how do I do that? And that's like a good teacher, I think, has to know what to do, but also how to do it and actually express it in a way that makes sense to you. So, for example, if we go, maybe the next book we'll do will be a bodhisattva, type of practice. But there are very specific ways to become more compassionate to others.
Right.
You notice certain things, like you notice the tendency to blame others. It's called the Lojong slogans, you know, the mind training slogans. And you go, notice every time you're blaming somebody else. I mean, you could be alone in your house. And you jam your finger on the door and you're ready thinking who left that door there, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And what's amazing about it is it does always seem to be like, if we're going to use the prison analogy, compassion always seems to be the door out, like that or the thing that disrupts that samsaric loop. The loop seems to be glued together by blame, lack of compassion. The moment
I'm going to interrupt you there, because that's right. But I think there's a second way of looking at it, which is glued together by ignorance or unawareness.
Okay.
So to me, I would say the awareness is one module of training and the compassion is another module of training, and they come together at some point.
I'm at this hotel in Denver, and I don't know if you've ever had this happen at a hotel. Like I had shows that night. And so I'd gone out, went to my room. The key didn't unlock the door. You know, that sucks just by itself. Cause you're like, great. My key doesn't work. You got to go back down the elevator. You get another key. You probably have to use the bathroom. So got a new key, went up, didn't work. Called down, said both. I think my lock's broken. So the manager comes up, tries their key, didn't work. Manager calls the engineer. The engineer comes up. He's got a key. Tries it. Does not work. I've got a show, man. I stink. I need to take a shower. And then, that's where I saw my self start, the thing in me that's a dick. That's where I start wanting to be like, this, you don't understand. I have a show.
Right.
This, what do you mean you can't open this? This is my room. I need to get in there. And somehow I just caught it. I caught it. And I'm looking at everyone involved. They all clearly feel terrible. They don't know what to do. Yeah. They're not malicious. No one sabotaged. They're all apologizing. No one sabotaged my lock.
Right.
Then another guy comes up with a weird tool. Like in the old days when we used to have the pull locks, open the door. And I did it, man. I wasn't being a dick. I didn't yell at you. Everyone's apologizing. I kept saying, please, it's not your fault. It's okay. Wow. So I never do that, David. I mean, I'm not bragging. I mean, it's awful that I'm never like that, but I'm not. I get mad, and especially with a show that I have to do and all the shit. So I got my room. And instead of standing in there, like coming down from like a rage fit and thinking about all the rotten things I said or the glares I gave, I didn't feel bad. And then the next day, they sent me a giant chocolate sculpture of a door with a out of order sign in front of it. It was so sweet, but that's like a new universe for me. That's, you know what I mean? Suddenly that experience never would have happened if I had subscribed to what my ego wants me to do in those situations, which is somehow get some petty revenge, some delusion that if I'm angry enough, the door will open faster or whatever.
So that's the zooming in part. Like,
yes,
you couldn't get that from experience from the aerial view. You got to live through it. And so that's why,
right,
the awareness is one piece, but the other piece is that we would call it purification. And it's hard to use that word because people might think it means that it's fundamentally dirty, which is not what it's saying. But we got to clean up our stuff, you know,
right,
because the clashes have begun to ferment, you know.
Right.
It's like ferment. You left something in the refrigerator too long and we're convinced it's good. It's leftovers. We're going to eat Chinese food from a month ago. And then it's just fermented. And then you got to clean out the fridge every once in a while.
So you're saying the cleaning out the fridge or the purification moment is the moment when it's like boots on the ground. Here's the situation where you always do the same fucking thing that always leads you to the same rotten place.
Yeah.
And you don't do it. And then in that moment, there is some kind of purification happening.
And so you're saying there are formal practices that cultivate that kind of perspective. You know, one is called the Vajrasattva mantra, which is you are visualizing this very pure white being, you know, that is kind of like, you know, not clouded or not congested in any way. And you're, you know, there's a mantra that's going with it. But basically what you're doing is you're resurfacing all your wounded shit and your what they call dikpa and dripa, you know, the kleshas and the obscurations that you have. You're inviting them to surface, to come to the surface. And this is like soap. Now I'm going to wash them.
I get it.
You know, it's like there's other practices.
That's cool.
Like 12-step has a practice like that. You know, you take accountability for what you've done.
Yeah.
You clean up your shed, you know.
No, that's really interesting. That angle's interesting because Yeah, it's not like the Klesias, it's not like these things like are always so prominent.
No.
It's a little bit like, I don't know if you've ever seen the way people get a bot worm out of someone's head. You ever seen those videos? It's fucked up.
Ooh, I like
they have to lure it. They have to lure it out. I think one I saw, they put a little piece of meat there or something. Yeah. I can't remember, but this worm sticks its head out. And then when it's there, you can like pluck the thing out.
Yeah.
But you have to get it to, you have to get it to come out.
Yeah.
And no, I get it. That's so cool because it isn't like, I mean, I'm sure there's some underlying asshole quality to me all the time, but like the focused assholeness, it requires a set of conditions around it to fully manifest. And then when it manifests, I get it. If in that moment you short circuit it by not doing the thing it wants you to do.
Yes, that's why you interrupt the flow of it.
Wow. And then that leads to boots on the ground, zoomed in spaciousness, in the sense that the way the universe is reacting to you now becomes, there's more room.
I'm going to give you an Indian head shake and a Stevie Wonder on that one.
Nice. I'll take it.
Yeah, boots on the ground and spaciousness at the same time, which is that's what, cool. You know, honestly, that's the exact quality that I would ascribe to the great teachers that I've ever met. They had boots on the ground. They weren't just spaced out and peaceful. They were really present and could do stuff and boots on the ground, but there was no sense of panic.
Right.
That's what had been extricated from it. And so there was no sense of accumulation of the armory of panic, which is all kinds of, elaborate defense mechanisms.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's quite refined. You know, it's, I don't think we're, I don't know. I'm a gradual path kind of person. I think it takes time and you work on it and you have friends and you have teachers and there are methods and, you know, lying beneath that is a very, present ability to just become awake on the spot. And we do
right.
that. We do that too. We have lots of, we're going to start doing that with Dharma Moon. We're having a retreat from May 1st to May 5th this year. That's going to be featuring this notion called wind horse, which is kind of raising that energy of wakefulness right on the spot. You just do
right.
it now.
And right.
it has to do with connecting with your body in a certain way and then sort of clearing the atmosphere a little bit and experiencing that kind of, we call it suddenly free from fixed mind.
That's cool. You know, because it also, it shifts the, like, you know, there's something really dreadful, at least for me, about when that kicks in. You know, the name for it now is Karening, where you like turn into, let me see your manager, that thing. You know?
Yeah, and they're on Instagram. There are like little Karen Instagram kind of files, right?
Yes. And so when my Karen comes out,
oh Jesus,
it's really like, it's always embarrassing.
Right.
It can't not be embarrassing because right. usually like the typical Karen has dehumanized somebody at a store or a restaurant, turn them into looking at them as some kind of servant mm-hmm. class piece of shit right. that doesn't deserve any right. anything other than being scolded or taught, like, this is a good, they always are talking about customer service. This is horrible. This is horrible customer service. And it's, and they just look so bad.
Yeah.
They look a million times worse than the person that they're angry at.
Yeah.
So there's something dreadful about it when you feel it coming out of, for me, it's like, I get restaurant claustrophobia. Where like after I'm done eating, I want to get the fuck out of there. I don't know what that is, but I just don't want to be in the restaurant anymore.
It's because the music's too loud and the sound system sucks and there's too much bass and you're trying to eat and talk to people.
Yeah, you just want, it's not even that. There's no, it is panic. It's like, it's stupid. Give me the fuck out of here. I'm trapped. I got to pay the bill. Like, where's the bill? And it's so dumb and it's always embarrassing. So what you're saying is really wonderful in that it's like suddenly those moments when they come, it's like, wait, here's a chance. Mm. Here's a chance. Now you're getting a chance to purify your Karen.
Okay, so that's a whole nother set of teachings that's called Shenpa. Shenpa. We may have talked about it before, but you use the Klesha eruption as a kind of alarm clock for instead of a, you know, you use the disruption to remind you exactly that this is the opportunity to do just what to practice on the spot. It's right. Very alchemical that way. You're using the neurosis to remind you of, you know, of shifting your relationship to it.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. So then the moments that you've been avoiding, because, you know, to go back to the New Age thing, spiritual bypass, it's like, it's more like you're trying to not look in the mirror to see all the holes in your head where bot flies have laid eggs. You know what I mean? You're putting on a toupee to cover up the bot flies in your head. You know, you're trying to overlook the what is really a gritty job. You know, you got to get some pliers. You got to get that thing to show itself first. That means
do you do this kind of rap as part of your comedy?
No, this would never work in a comedy
show. The botfly thing and covering it up. I bet there's a version of it that could be people.
I don't think in a comedy show I could be like, okay, so everybody, there's something called Klesha's.
No, you can't do it that way. You can do it that way. No, I agree.
But yeah, but I know it's very hard for me to. I mean, I would love to be able to. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you can make that funny. I mean, it is funny talking about plucking botflies out of your head, I guess.
But, yeah. You could make them coming out of other orifices.
You, it's, see, this is as opposed to other like spiritual traditions. I love this so much. I love it. It's so real and pragmatic and to the point so that you don't have to hide your Karen, but also you're not just letting your Karen run amok. You know, and being like, that's just who I am. I'm perfect. And my Karen is perfect.
Right.
It's use those moments. Those are gifts when they come. And then maybe they stop eventually.
Well, so those four kinds of suffering, you know, which Karen is in all four of those, because you're basically not getting what you want. That's what's happening right there. You're getting what you don't want is this, you know, person that you don't recognize in your neighborhood in a car or whatever it is. And, you know, you could say, okay, well, why did the Buddha and other people point that out? Why'd they point that? Because the next iteration, once you talk about the truth of suffering and then the cause of it, is the cessation of it.
Right.
People skip over that, or they try to get to that too quickly. They'd like to make the pain stop, like, you know, too fast rather than going through the process. But it is a cessation. So they would say, you know, a Buddha and somebody like us who's at that kind of fruition stage would not be Karen. They would have but tremendous sympathy and empathy for the Karen that they used to be and remember about. And the Karen that sometimes wants to surface but is kind of doesn't have a home anymore. And for all the other Karens floating around the world because – you know, it's not compulsive anymore to try to rebel against that experience.
I mean, I think there's a song. It's called "Sympathy for the Karen." The Rolling Stones did it. That to me, I think for sure. In fact, I have never met anyone who is more focused on the cessation of suffering. The first two noble truths. Everyone's infatuated with those and to the point where, and this is where it gets really like weird to me is that there's almost a kind of fetishization of the neurosis or something like the, you know what I mean? A real like attachment to look, I'm all messed up, man. Don't you see? Even though I'm on the path, I'm still all fucked up. And this is how I'm fucked up. And I'm really fucked up in this way. And that person's fucked up in that way. And you just get fixated on it instead of, it's like having shit on your hands and just be, look at all this shit on my hands. You see that there's shit all over my hands instead of wash your fucking hands.
And that's, like that's the purification.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. It's so, I mean, I don't mean to like make it so gross, but it is some, you can accidentally find yourself using your Karen side as like almost like a trophy or a a display of your unique traits, or I don't know, a way to.
Well, that's one extreme, Duncan, right? And the other one is bypassing it. You know, you don't really want to acknowledge your inner Karen.
Right.
You just want to get to the Holy Land or the blessed place, you know, not by any processing of what you're experiencing.
I haven't met anybody. I don't know anyone who does that. Anyone I've run into in the spiritual universe is always like kind of like hung up on themselves.
And really?
Mostly, and doesn't really believe that the cessation of suffering is possible, but but it's worth trying. It's worth
in that context. In that context, you know, just again, you know, I try to put this in terms of the context of the actual where the teachings have been iterated. There's, you know, there's a notion of transmission. It's very, very important at a certain stage that actually you meet somebody who has, to a certain extent, ripened,
and does have
some confidence, you know, in the fruition of these teachings, and also the qualities they embody, the qualities of it. So in Vajrayana Buddhism, that's you really can't practice it without that. There has to be, so like Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, we're not here just to keep some kind of rumor alive for centuries, you know, or some kind of, you know, myth alive.
Right.
It's really process each generation, and there are people who manifest and then pass that along. You know, I was very lucky, Duncan. I saw some people that I just unmistakably could invest in, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like you want to looking for, and, you know, it was like Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and Karmapa 16. Those beings were, I recognized them as human beings. They had all the great qualities, but you know, there was something really also simultaneously transcendent.
Right.
You know, and so then if I lose my Geiger counter, I can think about that fruition is not only possible, but actually at a certain point, you're obligated to retain your connection to it.
Right.
You can't cheese out, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I get it. No, I get it. I mean, I think that's the tragic, that's the cosmic giggle aspect of it, is it's like maybe you don't really want to end your suffering. Maybe that's just something you've been saying. You know, like when it comes down to it, you don't want to sacrifice, you feel like there's a sacrifice there of something that's very important. And even though you might intellectually know that,
well, it's there are subtler and subtler levels of it. And the way that Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about it, it's like sandpaper. The path is like six progressive stages of sandpaper. You start with the rough sandpaper,
right,
you remove the finish, and that's actually scratching the wood. Sandpaper is destroying the wood partially. And then you go to a finer level and it removes the stain of the previous sandpaper. Right. You go to a finer level until you're at a very fine level and the wood feels kind of smooth, but it's been really processed. So, progressive, like the book you're talking about, is progressive stages, you know, of practice. So I guess a lot of people out there are a little bit shy maybe of getting involved with what they think of as a tradition or a religion or something like that, and wanting to remain free, you know, and kind of footloose in a way.
Yeah.
But at some point, I think it is healthy to, like, not learn every instrument in the orchestra.
Right.
Pick one and get good at it.
No, I agree. No, I agree. And it's so rewarding. It really is. Like, it's such an exciting, to me, it's so exciting. There's so many, right when you think you've really, like, figured it out, like, right when you think you've really got a grasp on it, it just, like, an entire new dimension of it appears in front of you that you'd never considered or thought about. It's so beautiful in that way. I like progressive. I like the slow burn. There's something in it that's so beautiful and so obviously structured by many brilliant minds. Like it's an incredible, it's just incredible. Its age is incredible. Ethan was, we were talking about like Western psychology. He's like, okay, imagine if Western psychology had been around for 2,500 years. What would it look like? What would it be like? How advanced would it be? You know, and it was a really compassionate thing. I think I was accidentally, I didn't mean to, but was doing the old like spirituality better than psychology bullshit. And he was saying, yeah, but give psychology 2,000 more years and see where it is. Well,
you know? If you look at it that way, I think it's fairly safe to say it's a precocious kid, a smart kid.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm reading Freud right now.
Yeah.
You know, like to come out of the monotheistic, heavy-handed, you know, Western sort of, you can't really look deeply into the structure of the ego identity. Freud was doing that. Jung was doing that. And there's a lot of people working on both equations. I think people like you and I have also done therapy, right?
Yeah, of course. Yes. Yeah totally. I think it's very useful. And definitely, like, if we're talking about, what was the name of the practice where when your Karen pops out? Shenpa? Is that what you call it?
Shenpa, yeah.
Shenpa. So, yeah.
And by the way, there's a Pema Chodron writes about it in a book called Getting Unstuck. It's a series of audio. Getting Unstuck, that's the concept of it.
I'll make that my next one.
Very cool. Approach to use the Kalesha eruption as an alarm clock,
and that can happen in good therapy, like the Kalesha. I think Shinpa. It's probably, you could even argue that a lot of the modalities in psychology are some form of Shinpa. That in a safe space, this thing is getting summoned in a mindful space, which can heal that thing. Yeah. To some degree. Yeah, David, tell me about this class you have coming up.
Well, for those of you, there's so many folks who have been sort of tuning into our conversations over the last bunch of years. So I think some people will know and other people won't that we have a platform that's called Dharma Moon, dharmamoon.com. And so all of the, upcoming trainings are there. And what we did was we just developed, once the pandemic started, we developed a virtual platform. So people are online all over the world. And we have the original centerpiece was a mindfulness meditation teacher training program. And that's three times a year. So we have one of those coming up that starts in late March. Maybe we could post these on the website.
Yeah, sure. They'll be at DuncanTrussell.com.
So it'd be easy for people to find. It starts March 22nd, but as a prelude to that, you and I have often done an info session, which is going to be February 5th. And I think this podcast will be out before then. So I'm going to invite everybody here. Come February 5th and hear Duncan and I talking about beginner's mind. That's the topic. And then we'll have it also woven into that will be an info session for this teacher training program. And opportunity to learn about it. If you're interested, you should come to that, register for that info session. And we'll put the links up on it. So that's a five weekend course over about 4 months. And I've been amazed. We just finished one. There's so much love in the room at the end of it. You know, we're talking about meditation stuff, but people really bond over it. And it's virtual. So it's been a very happy gathering, and a lot of Dunkites. I call them Dunkites in there.
Dunkites?
No, that's bad.
They're the family, David. This is the family.
The family sounds like Charlie Manson. I don't know.
I know.
Oh, you like that? Okay.
Hey, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, man.
That's a good cartoon, a New Yorker cartoon. Charlie Manson. Well, you know Charlie Manson in the prison cafeteria. You know that one, right?
No.
He's sitting in the corner and he's saying, Jesus, is it hot in here or am I crazy?
He wasn't crazy.
So
crazy like a fox.
Well, okay. I mean, I'm going to not.
I'm just kidding.
Not going down that rabbit hole with you.
You know, in my acid days, I would watch videos of Charles Manson because I realized that when you're on acid, he really makes sense. It's like, when you're on ecstasy and like EDM music sounds good, you're suddenly like, oh, I see why people like this. When you're on acid and you watch Charles Manson talk, it's like, whoa, I get it now. I see what he's saying here, man.
Well, you know what, though? It is like that worm. We all do know how that feels.
Yeah, right.
To push hard, to you know, dominate a situation, to, there's a disconnect from some things. I think we could all agree that something got disconnected along the way, but there might be some progeny mixed in with the disconnect, you know?
Well, that's why it was so dangerous, because there was mixed in with the lunacy, mixed in with the, narcissism, mixed in with the hyperinflated personality. There's bits of truth that he'd connected to for real, which gave him his power. If he didn't have that, there would be no, Geraldo wouldn't want to talk to him. You know, it's the fact that mixed into the madness was some kind of like real existential philosophy that has its roots in a lot of other like Scientology. We got into that. There's all kinds of stuff. But, and also PS, would not recommend the practice if you're on a psychedelic of watching Charles Manson videos. I wouldn't recommend
and just
it.
To bring it down to a kind of simple, certain principles are ground principles, like ahimsa, not harming, you know, compassion, and like a mindfulness. So if we, you know, create our fundamentals out of those, then everything that develops, which has sort of cutting edge insight and stuff like that, will not turn into a nightmare for people, you know.
That's why it's that's why there is like some kind of like cautionary like advice with this stuff. That's why it's progressive. So it's to as much as possible avoid the situation where someone somehow maintains their attachment to identity and yet has some grasp on.
And in Vajrayana Buddhism, there's this very serious warning given before you undertake those kind of practices. And it basically says you could become an egomaniac at a very high level. So you're told that right away, not to be very humble, you know. So just coming back to Dharma Mundo for a second, we have that info session coming up on February 5th with you. And then we have, that course will start on March 22nd. You mentioned Ethan's course, which is just, might be underway by the time this is on the air, but it's still possible. And the other thing is we're having our first live retreat.
May.
Since Dharma Mundo started, May 1st to 5th, and that's open to the public. So
cool.
We'll post some of those up for everybody. And we always have a way of people asking questions and learning more about it. I usually do like 15-minute Calendly sessions with people who are thinking about doing it but want to know more about it. We're trying to put this training together in a way that's non-sectarian, that's not religious in its tone, it's not ritualistic to the extent that these things can become, and appeals to people also who want to engage in the world, you know, in active participants in the worldly activities. As opposed
Wonderful.
To renunciates. That's the deal.
You must take one of these classes. You will enjoy it and learn a lot. And obviously, David's a great teacher. So I hope you all will sign up. David, thank you so much for doing this week's podcast.
Thank you, Duncan.
And for guiding me through, helping me crawl along the floor of reality so I can burrow into someone's head and find a place to nest. Thank you, David.
I can't think of a better companion for the journey.
Thank you. Hare Krishna. Thanks, David. That was David Nichtern, everybody. You can find all the links to our info session, his class, Dharma Moon, at duncantrussell.com. I'll be back next week. Thank you to our wonderful sponsors. Thank you for listening. Thank you for letting me have this as a job. I love you. Hare Krishna.